Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today I'm here with co-host Russ Chianelli. And we're going to be talking to a faculty member from Oregon State University who's in something called the Center for Sustainable Materials Chemistry, materials science, you can also read into that. And what does that mean? It means trying to use green technology to solve some of the problems to do with materials. In particular, I want to get on to, she wants to replace lead, one of my favorite elements, in piezoelectric materials. Well, we'll find all about this later on, but the guest is Michelle Dolgos from Oregon State University. And Michelle, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Now, before we get into piezoelectrics and the wonderful element of lead, et cetera, tell us, how did you become what you are today, a scientist? What were those formative years when you finally said, ha, that's what I'm going to do?
I don't ever remember not liking science. I think it started with dinosaurs and fossils as a child. And I remember in sixth grade, I wanted to be an astronomer. And ever since then, it's kind of flopped around. And I don't think I ever knew I wanted to be a chemist until I took physical chemistry as an undergrad. And that's kind of sealed the deal for it. But until then, I just kind of flip-flopped between all different areas of science.
Well, physical chemistry is not one of the turn-on classes.
No,
usually.
No.
I mean, a lot of math in there. So you're pretty mathematical clued in.
Yeah. So I liked Gen Chem, and then organic almost scared me away, and then P-Chem kind of did it for me.
But do you remember, you know, looking under rocks in your backyard and that type of stuff? Where did you grow up, by the way?
In Michigan, just outside of Detroit.
But do you remember doing that? You know, I know that a lot of them say in the backyard I was looking at an insect or something.
Yeah, I remember my mom had a mineral collection, and we had this big cabinet with all these fancy kind of interesting rocks and stuff, and I was always interested in that. And still, I do a lot of crystallography, so I'm still interested in minerals.
Okay, so then you knew from the early part that you were going to be a scientist of some description. Where did you go to school, and did you do undergraduate research and things like that?
Yeah, so I went to Hillsdale College, which is a tiny liberal arts school in Michigan, and I did do undergraduate research there. And I actually thought I was really bad in the lab, so my PChem professor steered me towards computational, and I found I did a REU program in computational physical chemistry at Wayne State University in Detroit. And then after I actually tried computational, I realized I should actually be in the lab.
Does that mean you were spilling stuff on yourself?
Yeah, I don't know. I just didn't. I felt very clumsy, and I felt like there was this little, like, lab gremlin that followed me around. Like, I did. I had a hard time with analytical chemistry and all the titrations and how it had to be, you know, so precise. I kind of struggled with that. So my PChem advisor recommended computational chemistry.
I remember my high school chemistry teacher was on the third floor actually hanging people out the window because they breathed something bad in there.
We must talk about that again, Russell. This sounds quite interesting. Yeah. But anyway, after all these sort of fluctuations from one side of science to another, you land up in an institute. Let me give you the title properly. You landed up at the Center for Sustainable Materials Chemistry and Science.
Mm-hmm.
What does all that mean?
So as you mentioned, we look at sustainable materials. So we want to create materials that contribute to the sustainability of the planet, but then we also want to do it in a sustainable way. We use non-toxic starting materials, and we try to use low energy kind of inputs when we make these materials as well.
What's the definition of a toxic material? People tell us that benzene is toxic,
mm-hmm.
but in the laboratory, it's rather a useful reagent.
Yeah, right.
And you can recycle it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So are you at that level that you won't even use anything, even if you can recycle it, because of its potential for harming rats?
You know, we try to avoid things that are hazardous to human health, or anything that if you disposed of, it could hurt the planet.
So it's a disposable part that's the
important. So
like lead, where it's in a battery, they want you to recycle it, not throw it in the trench.
Well, yeah, there's also a lot of, like, as far as going back to the lead thing, a lot of governments want to try to regulate it completely. So it's regulated in things like paint, but it's not in electronics, which goes to the piezoelectrics, and that's because no one's found anything better than the lead-based materials. But I think as soon as someone does, they'll completely regulate that out as well.
Yeah.
Whose idea was this, to create this center at Oregon State University?
So this was Doug Kessler and Darren Johnson and Dave Johnson. So Doug is at Oregon State, and then Dave and Darren are at University of Oregon. So it started as a kind of a very small group of people, and they got this phase one grant from the NSF. And then from there, it's kind of grown. So we got a second level of funding, which is where we're at right now with the phase two center. So now it's grown to people sort of all over the country. There's professors and national labs, and we have some industrial partners as well.
So tell us exactly how that works, because you've got a center, and it's in Corvallis.
Well, it's mainly centered. The bulk of the people are in University of Oregon and Oregon State.
Now, you've got these associates scattered around the country in different institutions.
Yeah.
How do they work within your center? Do they simply do their own thing wherever they happen to be and collaborate if need be? Or is it more formalized than that?
So they collaborate where they're needed, but we have a lot of people who are really involved, like Sophia Hayes at WashU in St. Louis, and Rick Garfunkel is out at Rutgers. And we have weekly meetings where we meet over GoToMeeting online. So we have like virtual meetings. So that keeps everybody in touch. But they're really plugged into what we're doing, even over the distance. And it's because of this like technology where we can
meet.
What
I'm trying to get at is that the research projects that you look at are created by the people up there in the center. And then you look for collaborators that can bring to you a bigger interdisciplinary and a better focus.
Sophia has an expertise in solid state NMR. So she plays a large role in a lot of the projects with doing that.
Well, let's get on to this business of lead, because I'm intrigued by lead. I like it. You know, I've studied lead and germanium and tin. They're all there together in group 14. What is its role in – well, first of all, what is the piezoelectric effect for our fans out there?
All right. So the piezoelectric effect, it's reversible. So you can either apply an electric field and the material actually physically distorts. So if you use it in that way, it can be used as an actuator device.
A switch.
Or it can also go the other way around, where if you apply some sort of pressure or strain, it creates an electric field. So then in that way, it's used as a sensor.
Don't we have that in our brake systems in our newer cars, piezoelectric?
Yeah, and they're in your phones too. They're the gyroscope and in your phone, so it detects the tilt when you tilt your phone.
Yeah. So it's very useful everyday thing.
Yeah,
right?
It's one of those things that's in almost everything, but people don't really
know it's there.
Normally,
does it depend upon lead?
Generally. For the actuator applications, it is lead. It's a lead-based material.
And tell us more about the material.
So it's called PZT, and it's got lead, zirconium, and titanate. And it has the highest piezoelectric response out of everything that they've looked at so far. So it can move the most when you apply that electric field.
Yeah, so in other words, when you squeeze it, electricity comes out. And if you put electricity in, it stretches. Why does that happen? I mean, I know it's got to do with the symmetry of the crystal and all that, but...
Yeah, so as you mentioned, it does have to do with the symmetry of the crystal. So you have to have this sort of asymmetry inherent in the crystal for it to have this property.
Well, what do you mean by an asymmetry of a crystal? Most people will look at crystals and think, oh, it's lovely, it's very symmetrical quite often.
Yeah.
So what do you mean by asymmetry?
So I guess the best example is just to look at lead directly. So lead has this lone pair of electrons, which causes it to distort out of the center of the polyhedra.
Some crystals have a center of symmetry.
Right.
And some crystals, like some people, are acentric.
Okay. Yeah, so there's no center of inversion in piezoelectric materials.
If you divide all the materials in the world into those classes, that's some have symmetry.
And so then any crystal that lacks this symmetry is a candidate for the piezoelectric effect?
Yeah, so it has to be it's called a non-centrosymmetric space group. So there's a certain set of space groups that have this lack of a center of inversion. And anything that has that lack of center of inversion will be piezoelectric.
So there's a wide range of potential materials that could be piezoelectric.
Yes.
And so it's just the efficiency with the smallest amount of current and the biggest deformation that you're after.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So tell us, how do you go about saying, I want to substitute lead? Can you put tin, which is very similar, instead of lead? Or how do you go about doing this green alternative?
Yeah, so the kind of traditional way that people are looking at is replacing lead with bismuth. So they behave very similarly. But the problem with bismuth is that it's much smaller than lead, so it doesn't really fit into the same type of crystal structure. So people want to mimic the crystal structure, the exact structure that we see in lead, but put bismuth into it. But you often have to synthesize these at very high pressures to get lead to make the same crystal structure. But there are some bismuth-based materials where you don't have to do that. Other materials are like potassium sodium niobate. That's another one that has potential. And certain dopings of barium titanate, maybe, like you put barium titanate and mix that with other types of materials as well.
So you're using these words, and you bismuth.
Yeah.
Now, bismuth, that's always a great question in organic chemistry, the relationship between thallium, lead, and bismuth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've all got, you alluded to it, this lone pair of electrons.
Yes.
That dominates a lot of the chemistry in that low oxidation state. But is bismuth all that healthy?
So that's kind of debatable. Yeah,
we haven't just discovered the problems with bismuth yet, right?
Right. I don't know if as much has been looked into that yet. I mean, sometimes you read that it's fine, and then in other cases, I've actually read that it might be toxic.
Well, let me ask the question a different way. Do you have to have one of the heavy atoms in there? Can't you do it like with the first row lighter atoms, or do you need a big fat atom with all the electrons, like lead?
We'll let Michelle think about that. We'll take a brief break. We're at the halfway point. You're listening to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Michelle Dolgos from Oregon State University, who's thinking about an answer to a question. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Recently, a small group of people has been making history. An American student with Down syndrome is the first to graduate with honors in education. In Spain, another Down syndrome person became the first elected councilwoman.
100 years ago, this wasn't possible, since people with this chromosomal disorder were often ostracized. For as long as humans have lived on Earth, the belief is there have been people born with Downs.
The oldest confirmed case, though, comes from France through the discovery of a child skeleton. The child died 1,500 years ago during the early Middle Ages. What's interesting is that the way she was buried suggests she had not been stigmatized in life.
For centuries, people with Down syndrome have been part of art and literature. Only in the late 19th century did an English physician, John Langdon Down, publish the first accurate description.
But we'd have to wait until the 1970s for scientists to discover a person with Down syndrome was born with 3 rather than 2 copies of chromosome 21. You've also probably heard it called trisomy 21.
The discovery of a child's skeleton with Down syndrome was in the 5th or 6th century necropolis by a church in eastern France. 94 skeletons were unearthed along with the child, who was 5 to 7 years old.
The skull was short and broad with a flattened skull base and thin cranial bones, which are all features of Down syndrome. The child was buried on its back with its head in a westerly direction, common to all those buried there.
Archaeologists theorize, since the child was treated the same as the others in the community in death, that she was unlikely to have been stigmatized when she was alive. We'll need further proof, but it's a positive sign.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Michelle Dolgos from Oregon State University. And just before the break, we were talking about the whole concept of, you know, replacing nasty materials, or at least so-called nasty materials, like lead, with other more benign, possibly, materials like bismuth.
You talked about bismuth and lead, and these are heavy, what I call fat atoms with lots of electrons. Is it necessary to have an atom like that, a big fat electron? Or could we use some of the lighter atoms in the first row, for example?
So there is a piezoelectric material. It's aluminum nitride. And that material is used as a sensor. But it doesn't have a high enough response where it would be a good actuator. So that's kind of the typical sensor that's actually used in applications. But
so let's get this clear again. Actuator, sensor, mm-hmm. right? Switch. As opposed to something
yeah.
different.
Yeah, so an actuator.
What is used in your telephone? This is the key part where there's a lot of lead.
Mm-hmm.
What's the function in the telephone?
So that's when it's an actuator, so the switch.
So what's it doing? What's it switching on and off, and why is it important?
So you have different switches, so you can have an RF switch in a radio frequency switch in your cell phone. You can use, I guess one thing that people are trying to do, they're trying to use a actuator as the autofocus in your camera of your cell phone.
How does that work? How does you go from piezoelectric to now focusing,
yes.
Autofocusing?
Yeah, so
a big break.
Right. So the piezoelectric component would actually move the lens up and down, and it would move the lens to put your picture in focus.
That's pretty clever.
Yeah.
And LED does this for us.
It can, yeah.
I'm proud of it. It makes you proud to be a Group 14 chemist.
Yeah. So it's not used right now in cell phones, but it can be, yeah.
Let me ask you another question now that you're talking about a lot of science and computation and so on and so forth. But you're also going for an application.
Yes.
And I think, you know, in many universities, they're sort of closeted if you're a theorist, if you're a synthetic. But here you're going from basics to application.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So I guess we're just trying to use fundamental research for some sort of, you know, end goal. So we have an application in mind. So we're trying to make a switch or a micromotor using these piezoelectric actuators.
But that implies a interaction, interdisciplinary interaction between scientists, engineers,
yes.
business people. Can you talk a little bit about
yeah,
that?
Yeah. So I guess just an example of how it would work is, as a chemist, I like to make new materials. So what I would do is I would try to make a new piezoelectric material. And if I could find something different, then I can characterize it. But then what you want to do is actually put it into a device. And as a chemist, I don't really know how to do that. So then I would seek help from an engineer, like an electrical engineer, to help actually integrate that material into a device.
Talk about a little bit some of the progress you made. You got anything ready for commercialization or your group?
No, we're trying to think about that right now. So we're at the point where we're trying to, we have an idea of how to use a new synthetic technique to make a material that we hope has better properties. So right now we're just playing with the synthesis right now. So we're in very early stages at the moment.
But, you know, Russ brings up the point. This is a collaboration.
Yeah.
But at the end, from his point of view,
mm-hmm.
you've got to have a product.
Yes.
You've got to have someone out there that's either commercially involved now
yeah.
or wants to commercialize it.
Yes.
And you sent that your center up there in Oregon has industrial partners.
Mm-hmm.
So are they somehow... do you have a little team of advisors that say, hey, Michelle, we got this problem with piezoelectric materials? Or how does that work? What input do you get? And what help do you get
right.
from the industrial people who are likely to benefit from your research?
So right now we're at the stage where we have this program called Lens of the Market. And it's run by Ecos VC, and we've partnered with them, and they've actually helped us with doing a market analysis to try to find this application market pairing to see where our, you know, where our product, if we were to have one, could actually benefit.
You're looking for that little niche.
Yeah, so we're looking, yeah, where we could actually make a product, you know, because...
Can you describe the company a little bit more,
Ecos VC? So they... help. They run this workshop with a lot of universities. So as I mentioned, the CSMC is an NSF-funded center, and there's several other ones. So they work with all these other centers and run workshops that teach scientists how to – they kind of teach them the business aspect of it and how to – identify science as innovative and how to do a market analysis. And we've actually interviewed businesses to try to see if they would actually be interested in a product.
Well, that's one of the ways I was going.
Yeah.
I mean, how much help do you get from the industry that is likely to benefit you in the end? Even though you don't have a product now,
mm-hmm.
do you find them proactive and coming to you and say, oh, this is a great idea. Here's a little help. Here's $100,000 or something like that.
We've not gotten any funding, but there are people who have expressed interest. But I don't think most businesses would be really invested until you had a working prototype.
Yeah. And that to me is part of the problem.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, the chicken, the egg, you know, you're battling away there and you're trying to get tenure and you're trying to get
yeah.
some new materials, and all of a sudden it's not successful,
mm-hmm.
but you've not had any support up to that stage, and now you're not going to get any at all. You know, I mean, it's a delicate business.
Definitely, yeah. So we're at the point where we think we have a good application for our material, but I don't think we would get any sort of business funding or help or anything until we had a prototype.
But I think there's another part there that's interesting, because we started off talking about sustainable materials, but we also have to talk about whether or not they can make a profit.
Right. Yeah, so that's kind of in talking to businesses, if you know, we went through one round where we were looking at using piezoelectrics as micromotors. And when we talked to different companies, they all used the lead-based material, PZT, and they weren't really interested in anything because they were happy with the way that it works with lead. Everything's fine. They're comfortable with the way that it's made, the process, and how it works, and the predictability. So I think unless it has to perform equally as well or better for it to be replaced.
Well, let's pursue that a little bit. How much lead is in one of these little devices? Let's take my little telephone. I mean, are we talking milligrams, micrograms?
It's probably a very small amount.
Well, yeah, I'd realize that.
Actually, but, yeah.
So, I mean, there's probably more lead in one lead bullet than in, you know, the
or,
whole
or
number
to
of cell
phones.
An
example is your car, you know, where your lead-acid battery contains, you know, 10 to the 6 more lead than the sensors in your brakes.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, because a lot of, like, the, you know, the sensors are very thin films, or for the actuators, it's a very thin ceramic disc. And there's also, you know, it's lead, zirconium, titanium and oxygen as well. So it's not like it's just lead.
So how about replacing the battery with pounds of lead in it? That's something a lot of people are working on too.
Well, that's right. Let me change topics just a little bit. You're at the beginning of a career.
Yes.
Right? And that's perhaps the most difficult part of a career. Russ is in the middle to the end of his career, as am I. And, you know, we've got a certain set of contacts. Do you do much networking as a new faculty member with other new faculty members
yes.
around the country?
Yeah.
Tell us how that works and what's it useful for.
So there's actually a workshop in D.C. every year for new faculty members in chemistry. It's called the Cottrell Collaborative Workshop, and I've met a lot of new faculty members there. It's for first and second year faculties, and they actually they teach you how to teach, because we really don't have experience in that. And they, you know, they teach you different ways to get grants, or, you know, maybe difficult situations that may come up in running a group and things like that. So that was really helpful. And then we still have webinars with the group once a month after the – or not once a month, like once a term after the workshop, which has been helpful.
Let me ask another question, too. One of the things that we have been doing recently here, which I find very interesting, is that we reached down – to high school students and try to interest them in science. And I had an experience where we had a high school teacher in one of the classes, and we were talking about photovoltaic cells, and he says, I have 20 students this weekend making PV cells. And then I always ask him, did you teach them how to write invention disclosures? Do you do things like that? Is that coming?
Yeah, there is a program at Oregon State called it's Advantage Accelerator Program, and you know, they'll teach you how to do market analysis. They'll teach you about the patent process and what you need to do. If you think you might have something that's patentable, how you need to deal with that from the beginning.
But, I mean, these programs that reach down to the high school, like we started off the program talking about, oh, you're interested in chemistry and so on and so forth. We find that when we interact at the research level with students in high school, we get some very interesting results, and then they sort of focus on coming toward us over the long run.
Yeah, I mean, we do outreach with high school kids, but I don't think we've ever talked about patents.
That was a bit of a joke I made, because they were working on these things in teams.
Yeah.
And I just made a joke. Well, suppose they make a great discovery.
Yeah, it's definitely something to think about.
It's a very interesting discussion, because what you've talked about really is interdisciplinary. And one of my last questions is, you sort of went away from the theory. Do you have some theorists cranking away? Because I found over the years that if you get the theory going correctly, you can reduce the number of experiments that
yes.
you do.
Yeah, we definitely have theory people working on the project. Kind of one of the big grand challenges for theory is predicting structures, and, you know, predicting stable structures. Are if I throw these atoms in, will they give me the structure I want? So that's kind of the holy grail, I guess, of synthetic chemistry that everyone's plugging along on.
Has anybody done that yet in this general area? One always sees theoreticians, you know, slowly getting closer to the experiment. And then a great experiment comes along and they're left in the dust again. And, you know, it's that sort of a process.
Right. Yeah. I don't think anyone's kind of been able to do it consistently, but we're working on it.
Well, we've consistently run out of time after about 28 minutes.
Yeah.
So we've done that again, okay?
Okay.
So Michelle Dolgos from Oregon State University, as a member of the Center for Sustainable Materials Chemistry and Science, I add that. And it's been great fun having you here. And Russell, it's nice to see you back again.
Yes,
you,
I'm very happy to be back. And thanks, Michelle, for being here. Please come back. And thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
I hope you all enjoyed it, and be back next week for another Science Studio. Bye-bye.
Thank you.